everybody. It is Katie Kestner. I am the primary host of the Dear Katie podcast, and we are so delighted to have you take this journey with us on our weekly podcast episodes. I just want to remind everyone to do great self-care. Thriving is part of the purpose of this podcast, and we definitely want you to take a break at any time. Warm bath, fresh air, walk a dog, have a bite of chocolate, whatever you need to do good care for yourself. Just as a reintroduction, if you're not familiar with me, I am the woman who was on the cover of Time magazine at age 18 as the first in history to speak out nationally and publicly as the victim of date rape. And HBO made a film about me, and I went on to become the executive director of the Take Back the Night Foundation. We are the oldest, largest global movement on sexual violence in all forms for all people in the world. So we encourage you to visit our website for lots more information. So I'm going to turn it over to our host and our guest for today. Welcome again to the Dear Katie podcast. This is Katie Kestner, and we are so excited to join with us today a gentleman who has worked in the field of advocacy for survivors. And we'll get to that in just a second and have Guy introduce himself. In the meantime, as everyone knows, it's really important to us that you do good self-care. If you need to take a pause, please do so. Everything we talk about can be very triggering and traumatic, but I have a feeling you're going to love meeting Guy and hearing about the vision of advocacy through all kinds of legal paths. So I am ready to welcome Guy DeAndre. Guy, share a little bit about yourself and your journey to become an attorney and what you do for victims.
Sure. Thanks, Katie, for having me. I'm very excited to be on your show. As you said, my name is Guy DeAndrea. I grew up in the Philadelphia area. From a very large Italian Catholic family. And I sort of grew up around storytellers. Most were in the construction industry, but they were just phenomenal storytellers, probably lawyers in a different life. And no one knows in my family where I got the drive to want to be an attorney. It's just for some reason, from a very young age, apparently I was saying that this is what I wanted to do. And then ultimately, as I went through law school, I didn't know exactly what path I was going to go down. And I had a wonderful mentor who had convinced me to have a clerk or internship at the Chester County District Attorney's Office representing survivors and victims in my second year of law school. Doing that for even just a couple of days, I knew that working with victim survivors was all that I ever wanted to do. It drove me, it created a passion in me that has never ceased. And so after graduating law school, I was hired by the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office. I was in the child sexual abuse room for a long while, and then ultimately promoted to major crimes, and then promoted to homicide, where I spent my last 5 years at the District Attorney's Office, where I also saw all forms and of sexual violence related to homicides as well.
Wow. That sounds really hard.
Yeah, it was, but when you work with the families and the moms and the dads, the brothers, the sisters, the partners of deceased ones or individuals who are living but went through a horrific violent act, that's what motivates you. It really does, because so many of the families that I represented in large part never had anyone advocate for them and felt at many times like they didn't have a voice in the system. And at least I tried everything I could to make sure that they had that voice. And it's the reason that drove me to Laffey Boosey Kent, the firm that I'm now a partner at, because I was able to work with my law partners and other partners exclusively in the what we call crime victim civil side of the law. So representing victim survivors in the civil side against the institutions that have allowed sexual violence, physical violence, bullying, and hazing to occur.
Gotcha. Well, let's then delve into, Guy, what it looks like for a victim to come to a civil suit? What does that entail?
Sure. And oftentimes, initially coming in, survivors don't fully appreciate or understand, understandably so, that there is a civil remedy at times for sexual and physical violence. You know, many people think that the criminal aspect is the only way or the only form of potential justice. We also get many survivors who don't want to do anything after a criminal matter because of how they were treated in the criminal matter. So those who call us, we're very proud that our practice is 100% trauma informed. You are respected and listened to and believed. And all of our staff, from the paralegals to our intake specialists to our associates to our paralegals, all work exclusively on the side of the firm that I'm on with survivors. And all of the lawyers are all former prosecutors who at times had experience with the criminal side of things as it relates to prosecuting perpetrators. So we can oftentimes walk survivors through both the criminal and civil systems because both are scary and they can be. And so the civil system, though, I mean, the difference is survivors have an actual attorney representing them, meaning in the criminal side, prosecutors don't actually represent the victim survivor. They're representing the Commonwealth or the state or the government. But on the civil side, they have a lawyer sort of in their corner fighting for them with attorney-client privilege who are shielding them from a large aspect of the litigation so that, you know, they're not in and out of court like they often are in the criminal side of things. Mm. And I, you know, I can go into as much detail. I don't know how granular you want me to get, but you know, it's really making sure that survivors find the right fit so that their story, their truth is told in an effective way where we can get real substantive changes industry-wide, but also provide civil justice to survivors who oftentimes need it for mental health treatment, for other forms of treatment, or really whatever they need.
Guy, let's talk about one thing you just mentioned. When survivors come to your, you know, practice and you support them, can you give us some examples of what some hurdles you've encountered? You know, when do survivors say, I can't do this anymore? Or what support mechanisms should they be seeking when they come to decide this is what they want to do? Like, can you give us some examples of like two or three cases where it's been hard and the victim has felt like, I'm not sure I can keep going?
Sure. We've had a couple of cases to that exact point in terms of things being difficult. Sadly, I've had one client take his own life during the litigation. And it shatters me to the core, losing that young man. And he had been through sexual violence, and I don't like to compare traumas because it's not healthy or fair to any survivor. But on paper, he had been through a level of violence, a sexual violence that I had not seen. It was a first for me. And I felt like I had seen, I mean, just about everything at that point in my career. And, you know, it was challenging. We had support systems in place for him. He was homeless. So we had him, we got him in within different organizations to help support him for housing, providing a cell phone so he could communicate with us if there was an emergency, checking in with him almost on a daily basis. And so that was really challenging and to make sure he was safe. And then when he took his life, it was devastating. And we're still close with his relatives, his distant relatives who were trying to also help. And it was it's a very long story, but that was hard. I mean, I felt like that was a very unique circumstance. A lot of people, the more common sort of where people start to get cold feet, if you will, is around significant moments of the case. So when it's time for testimony, right? So that's depositions where you're in a conference room or in front of the defense attorneys, never the perpetrator, usually, I mean, generally speaking, but the defense attorneys can be intimidating. So some of the ways we alleviate that is with extensive prep. So we meet with the clients as often and as many times as they need to get as ready as possible for that. We also utilize specialists in the field for preparation for depositions. who also have a trauma-informed background. We make sure that if a client has gender preferences for prep or for meetings, right? There are some clients who only want to speak to a man, and there's clients who only want to speak to a woman. And that's not divided on gender lines. I see a lot of times women only want to speak to men and men only want to speak to women. And so we make sure that, of course, that if that is something that a client wants and that's going to make them feel as comfortable as possible, that's an easy thing to do for a client. And it's checking in with them and making sure constantly through updates and through even, hey, how are you? Right? Just let's talk about how things are going, not even about the case. Because I don't want every call to feel like, oh, he's calling me about the case. We really at LBK, my firm, really care about every single one of our clients, and we want that to be known from the very beginning.
That's perfect, Guy. I'm so glad to hear that. Obviously, for our listeners, Take Back the Night has partnered with Guy's firm in the past, and we are going forward with a more robust approach to our legal support hotline. A next step, Guy, then maybe you could share what are the outcomes and benefits that you feel you've achieved for survivors? What do they say, I'm so grateful that blank, what happened for them? Can you give us a couple examples?
Sure. I will say from a global perspective, and I mean this, I have never had a client at the end of litigation say they regretted it. No one likes being in litigation, and certainly there are trying times for each of my clients. But at the end, the overall sort of feeling and statements that I get from clients are, it all sort of sums up into that was a cathartic experience. I got to confront the organization or the people who did this to me, and I was able to actually tell my full story versus in criminal court where it's very selective because of the rules of evidence in terms of what can or can't come in. I make sure that in the civil case, the full story is told. Everything they want to say about what happened and how it affected them, they get that platform, they get that voice. And so that experience of oftentimes an uninterrupted telling of what happened, and how that has affected them is in and of itself, while scary, cathartic. But then on a more tangible results, we have seen resolutions that involve negotiating large sums of money for a charity or a foundation of the client's choosing, or significant changes in the regulations or rules or safety procedures that govern an industry. We have a lot of cases, as an example, against the massage industry, where oftentimes it relates to women being sexually assaulted. But now as a result of that litigation, any major chain, for the most part, massage beds have panic buttons now installed underneath so that if a woman or a man, but more often it's women in that industry, is being assaulted or just doesn't feel comfortable, she can push that button and it will automatically trigger someone coming into the room to protect and or save them.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible, Guy. What an achievement. Can you describe you won a large suit and the outcome was an industry-wide change?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the lawsuits that were filed against the massage industry. All of the lawsuits across the country sort of had that impact. And you know, as the culmination of it right now, do these organizations make system-wide changes because it's the right thing to do? This is the skeptical side of me, and I don't know the true answer because you can't get inside their heads, but I don't believe they're doing it for the right reason, right? I mean, the right reason would have been to have these safety procedures and protocols in place before they're sued, right? Meaning prevent it from happening before it happens. But it's happening because they don't want to get sued anymore. So while I'm not happy about their motivation, at least safety is being addressed and changed through litigation. And then a real tangible benefit for the survivors is that civil side does provide, if successful, financial recovery for the victim survivor. And so some of the biggest success stories that sort of, warm my heart, and I still get pictures and I love it. I've represented or have represented and currently represent individuals who don't have homes, who live either shelter to shelter or literally live on the street. And one client in particular you know, I almost feel like I'm making this up, but he was in Tennessee, living physically under an underpass, like under a bridge. And through the litigation, I was able to achieve a seven-figure, so millions of dollars for that survivor, and set up a trust for him and set up all the things that needed to be in place, of course, with his permission. And so we were able to take him from that tent to now get the net with the finances that are put in place for him. He has a home, his own home. He has the mental health treatment he desperately needed. He has a vehicle so he can go to and from work. He has like I said, the trust that's set up will pay out monthly for the rest of his life. And so it's not all about money, of course not, but mental health treatment, sometimes inpatient treatment, when we know from all the statistics that when someone's sexually assaulted, especially as a child, the rates of alcohol and drug dependency are through the roof. And so you need all these systems in place to protect, help, and ideally make or allow that person to live what I like to call their second best life. And you can't really do that though without finances, right? And so the civil litigation oftentimes can provide that recovery, that financial recovery, so that the other areas in their life that they need can be satisfied.
My hope is that our listeners will better understand the system. I think we missed one thing, is like the hotline that we have is free.
Sure.
There's no cost to call and learn. So from the outset, maybe walk our survivors through what cases can you handle civilly and what cases can't you handle?
Sure. And that's a great point, Katie, in terms of the hotline being free, but also consultations with attorneys. And ultimately, the case, while it's not free, you're not paying out of pocket, right? So the type of law that we practice falls under the larger umbrella of what's called tort law. And attorneys in this space, whether it's representing victim survivors, whether it's representing catastrophic medical malpractice, all of those attorneys, including myself, work on what's called a contingency fee. And so a client never has to worry about, but I can't afford litigation, because myself through the firm and through my partners, we fund the litigation until its conclusion. So clients don't have to worry about outlaying any money whatsoever. And so, you know, calling in and getting advice or hearing things out is critical. And every survivor should at least get that option, or at least hear their options. And so generally speaking, cases that can be really successful in the civil litigation world are cases that involve an institution. So what does that mean? It means cases that have, you know, think of any type of church, whether it's the Catholic Church, whether it's evangelical, Baptist, Scientologist, you name it, right? Institutions like churches, daycare centers, boarding schools, hospital settings, psychiatric settings, massage institutions, work places of work, right? I mean, any place that involves a business, a company, an institution, whether nonprofit or profit, whether state or non-state, meaning government versus non-government, these are all areas that can be very successful in terms of a potential recovery for survivors. To be candid, where it gets tricky, Katie, is where there isn't an institution. And I'm not saying there's never a circumstance in which you could go after an individual perpetrator, but the difficulty is, and I know it sounds like it makes it all about money, but the only recovery available if a case goes to trial in civil justice is financial. So if it's an individual perpetrator who otherwise is insolvent or doesn't have any money, I would advise a survivor, certainly we could go through litigation, but at the end of it, there's not, even if we win, there's not going to be recovery for you. And that's a lot to go through when you know the outcome before you even start, if that makes sense.
It does. It does. I think it's like a hard pill to swallow, but it's the truth. And those cases can only then perhaps do criminal if the statute hasn't expired. Wow. Well, I guess maybe in the last like 10 or so minutes that we have with you, Guy, what, you know, tell us a little bit about what makes you happy when you have a full, you know, experience with a survivor and what the outcome is that you know, really resonates with everybody, like we accomplished something.
Sure. What makes me happy representing survivors is always at the end, or even during, when you can see the change, when you see the strength in the survivor. And I don't mean to say that survivors are weak at certain areas or certain points. What I mean is you see there's a different type of strength that comes out more often than not in litigation, where there's a fire in the survivor who's like, no, I'm ready. I'm ready to go to battle. And that you, like, you're ready to fight with them. And you see that sort of fundamental change. We had a young woman who was horrifically sexually assaulted at a university who did not want to do her deposition. Like, I mean, the thought of it petrified her, let alone having to sit there for potentially 7 or 8 hours. And after multiple prep sessions, and, you know, it was challenging, right? It was very challenging. It was very emotional. But about an hour into the deposition, she said, can we take a break? And we stepped out, of course. And I can't go into too much detail because I'm going to talk about the conversation. I can't really tell you the facts of what university or anything along those lines because of attorney-client privilege. But, you know, there was like a change in that first hour. She's like, I'm ready. No, I see what they're doing in there, and I'm ready to go to war. And you prepped me, your whole team prepped me, and I'm ready. Like, you, it was like almost like, you know, the first round of a boxing match. I know it's a stupid analogy, but like, no, I'm ready to get back in there and I'm ready to fight. And it was, awesome. Yeah, those moments, they fire me up and they fire the team up, and it makes it all worth it. And seeing the positive impact you have on the survivors, their families, how they work through the trauma, and just seeing the changes in them by the end, in the positive way, for the most part, that's what drives me every day.
That's fantastic, Guy. I'm so grateful. You've given us so much clarity around this whole process of justice. And we are delighted, Take Beth and I is, to partner with your firm and you for this important journey for so many survivors. I guess the last question I have is, you know, what changes do you see upcoming with some of the statutes that might make it easier for victims to pursue justice? Are there any such changes on the horizon?
Yeah, the law changes all of the time across the country. And what makes it tricky is that the individual states change their laws individually, right? So it's really important. A lot of survivors that I represent in New York, for instance, never thought for a second that they would ever have a chance at justice because maybe it's been 10, 15 years. But just for all the listeners, many states have opened or are currently open what's called window legislation. And what that means is it allows survivors to bring a lawsuit when the window, the quote unquote window, is open, no matter how old the case is. So many states have child sexual abuse windows. In other words, if you were sexually assaulted as a child, you can sue your perpetrator and you can sue the entity, like a corporation, business, church, etc., that allowed it to happen. And so in those states, no matter how long ago it happened, you can bring a lawsuit within that time frame. New York just passed, and unfortunately it's already closed, but New York was one of the first states to also have an adult survivor window. And so people who were sexually assaulted as adults, who generally speaking only have a year to 3 years, depending on the state, to bring a lawsuit. And we all know from working with survivors that many people are nowhere near ready to discuss it, work through it, certainly participate in a lawsuit a year or so after the event. And so that window allowed adults to bring claims when they otherwise would not have been able to because of the statute of limitations. And so you're seeing all these windows open, both in the child sexual assault abuse cases as well as now the adult cases. So it's really important to, you know, whether you follow it yourself or reach out to a firm like ours or whoever you're comfortable with, to check on that law, to see if there's remedies available to you. And many states are also, putting aside windows, they're extending the statute of limitations. And as an example, I'm currently in West Virginia on a large boarding school sexual assault case. And in the middle of this litigation, the West Virginia legislature changed the statute of limitations to the age of 36 for child sexual abuse cases, and they made it retroactive. So all of a sudden, clients who I wasn't able to represent because of the statute of limitations, I now can call them and say, a new window's open. You're no longer outside the statute of limitations, a new statute of limitations has been passed. You can now, if you want, bring a civil suit if you want to join the litigation. And it's changed so many young women and men's lives being able to do that. So states and legislatures are really being proactive about this, and survivors shouldn't think or give up thinking there's no hope for me or there's no potential remedy for me. There may very well be, because of how the different legislatures, Supreme Courts across the country are recognizing, which everyone in the industry has known forever, that having a 2 or 3 year window in terms of a statute of limitations, when the vast majority of survivors could take a decade or more to feel quote unquote comfortable even talking about it. So that the law is finally catching up what has been a reality for sexual assault survivors for so long.
Guy, that was beautifully said. And I feel like our conversation, you project such hope and confidence and welcoming to our listeners. I think, you know, you've given us so much to think about and openings that are becoming available as we speak, literally.
Yeah.
And avenues for justice and healing. And, you know, from the trauma of losing your homeless gentleman to some of the most empowering things you've talked about, I know it's a personal journey. And what I'm hearing from you is your firm believes in sitting with each individual survivor and figuring it out one at a time. It's not a cookie cutter experience. It's a fully supported experience. So I'm delighted that we are partnered with you all. Yeah. And that you're so committed to this long-term vision for justice and the scope of justice and how we can achieve it. And at the same time, making sure each and every individual feels fully supported in their journey with you. So,
absolutely.
My goodness, thank you so much. I'm thinking if we missed anything for survivors and victims who are like still worried, but I think, you know, just on the takebackthenight.org website, you can click on, you know, legal support, and there's a form, an intake form. There's also the hotline if you want to talk to a human. But, you know, just to learn more, there are friendly folks who will talk to you.
Yeah, and Katie, to that, if I could, real quick to that point, all survivors should know when you're speaking with a law firm, whether it's a intake specialist, a social worker, a paralegal, or an attorney, every single one of those conversations, even the very first one where you're not even a client yet, they are all protected by the attorney-client privilege. In other words, if a survivor calls me and says, I want to talk about what happened, and I listen to them, and then they say, you know what, I really appreciate your time, but I actually am not ready to proceed. That conversation is forever privileged, confidential. Like literally even a judge could never force me to say a word about that conversation. So no survivor should feel like if they tell their truth to an attorney or to legal representatives that that could ever get out there or leaked or anything like that. It's the quickest way for a lawyer to lose their license to practice law. And I could never even fathom a lawyer breaking that oath.
That's so helpful, Guy. I think that's really confidence building. A secondary question, though, is some of our listeners might be 16. Mm-hmm. They might not be 18, a legal adult in the U.S. What should the ones who are not legal adults do?
Yeah, so if someone's a juvenile under the age of 18 and they have a conversation with us, they certainly can. Sometimes they want parents to be present, but there are some juveniles who don't. I've had cases where I have spoken to people under the age of 18 who did not, for a whole host of reasons, familial abuse that was happening in the home, and they did not want their parents at all involved. Now, that gets challenging, but one of the options, depending on – and of course, it's always, you know, circumstance depending. But one of the options is, because in most states – no one has to file a lawsuit if they're still under the age of 18 well into, you know, past their 18th birthday, meaning they have the time. So I've had clients who say, like, can I just keep talking with you, but we don't do anything until I turn 18 and then I'm in charge. And I, absolutely, let's wait till you're 18 if that's what the client wants, right? If, and of course, staying in touch, making sure they're safe, making sure they're protected, right? There's all the different factors that go into it. If the juvenile does not want another adult sort of involved or directing the litigation. Otherwise, if parents are involved, and I have many, many cases, the vast majority, where parents or a guardian are involved heavily when it's a child who has been sexually abused or physically abused, then the parent, just so listeners know, I mean, the parent is technically in control of the litigation up and until the child turns 18. Now, not all a case could be resolved before someone turns 18, but for someone who's under the age of 18, generally speaking, parents are involved if the lawsuit is filed prior to their 18th birthday. But if there's a recovery, a financial recovery, when it's the person is still a child, the one who's been affected, we make sure that any financial recovery is approved by the court, and it's then put into some form of a trust or sat with a trustee or sat with a guardian. I'm not saying all parents would do this, but there's plenty who would take that money for themselves, and we make sure that that will never happen.
Wow, Guy, that's so reassuring for any of our minors listening to the podcast.
Sure.
I really appreciate you going into detail on that. I wanted to take a moment and share another facet of my life with our listeners that I don't always share. So as many of you know, my assault happened when I was 18, so I was an adult. It was the third weekend of my first year of college. And back then, there were not great laws and policies in place. But, you know, it's not, I share this because it's unique to the conversation we're having. There were a handful of attorneys back then. Not many people were very victim-centered and helpful. It was many times, even on some of the national shows and television that I was on, that it was very exploitative and not very comfortable. There were plants in the audience sometimes when I go on a talk show to attack me. And I tried to press criminal charges, but the district attorney would not take my case because it was one word against another. And the evidence I had was only a bare minimum of bruising and tearing noted by a doctor 5 days later. And the lawyers that wanted to sue my very wealthy perpetrator came at the conversation with me, Guy, and for our listeners, like not with anything other than I felt like a money grab. And the one thing I told myself back then was I didn't want his money, even if I could have won, because I thought he would have paid for me somehow. Like, he could justify, oh, I paid that money, so I'm free from guilt. And, you know, I'm older now, but that was me thinking at age 18, being fierce and feisty and singular-minded on my own, what it meant to me to be a survivor and be beholden to none. But, you know, Guy, you're painting a different picture than what I, you know, thought about back then. And it sounds a lot more welcoming and different. And I also like that you mentioned that some survivors, like I, could have chosen a foundation to give the money to, or I might have been able to make him do something that he didn't want to do that would equate to community service or some other lasting consequence that would be other than a check in the mail. And so I kind of land with, are those all viable options for survivors?
Yeah. So in the settlement negotiations, I mean, truly you can, I mean, all parties have to agree, but if the case resolves prior to trial, then anything can be negotiated. And like, mm-hmm. I've seen all sorts of unique things. And because it's important, you have to listen to what the victim survivor, your client, wants. And you have to also meet them where they are, right? If you treat every case as the same, you're going to have, and you should have, a lot of dissatisfied clients, especially when you're talking about sexual assault cases, right? Attorneys, and I'm not knocking these, I have many friends who do car accident cases and those types of cases. They're a lot different. They are in many ways much more cookie cutter, right? And sexual assault cases are not like that. And you can't treat every single survivor even remotely the same. Everyone's in a different place of healing. They have a different emotional reaction. They have a different physical reaction to a sexual assault. And so you have to work with and really understand what is the goal in a perfect world. I mean, in a perfect world, the assault never would have happened. But, you know, what is the outcome that the client wants to see? Now, you can't overpromise, right? I mean, you have to be realistic with clients. But, you know, if I've had clients say, I want to negotiate with the adjusting, you know, adjusters or the organization that, yeah, I receive a financial recovery, but I want X amount of dollars coming from their pocket directly to this foundation. We've negotiated that all the time. I want, you know, this policy change, that policy change. Happens all the time. And the reason I keep talking or speaking about how that has to happen pre-trial, if that's going to happen, because at trial, it's up to a jury. And the only thing a jury is allowed to award is money, right? I mean, they can't award something else. That is the recovery that they would be awarding in these types of cases. And so any of those types of non-financial or financial, but to another entity, like a foundation, that can all be negotiated through what we call the mediation process.
That's perfect, Guy. Oh my gosh, what a brilliant conversation we've had. I feel like you were so clear and so...
I hope so.
Yeah, no, it was amazing. I'm personally grateful for you and your work and your personal journey to come to where you are now, and glad to point any survivor in your direction who needs a supportive, brilliant mind to make advocacy happen and make it feel very comfortable through the whole, you know, every step of the way. Do you have anything you want to add before I wrap up our conversation?
I would just say that, you know, at Laffey Boosey Kent, we're so blessed because we have teams of attorneys and paralegals who work with survivors. So, you know, if you came to our firm and it was in both sides agree that this was, we can represent you and you want to be represented by us, you know, on my personal team, you know, Jill Roth and Mike McFarland, the two attorneys working with me are absolutely amazing, both former prosecutors. Brian Kent, my law partner who founded this practice of crime victim, you know, 15 years ago, in the Philadelphia area for this firm. You know, he's amazing. And then, you know, you have Stu Ryan, Alex McMaster, Ali Stuplin, all fantastic attorneys, as well as a whole support staff just working for each survivor. And we're really proud of that. And we're proud that that will afford so many of our survivors the best possible representation, because it's not just one person working for you. And sometimes that works and that's good, but you have a whole team. You have a whole team, an actual team fighting for you. And it's really important. And we've seen the positive results we're able to achieve because of that group or team mentality, all with the same mission, all with the same drive, and all with that same fire to fight for survivors.
Perfect, guys. It sounds like very welcoming. So for everyone listening, thank you again, Guy, for joining us. And all that you painted, it was a very clear and positive, you know, experience that we can look forward to offering to more of our listeners and your friends and survivors alike, you know, family members, anyone who you know who might be in need of legal support. And part of the healing journey is potentially holding someone or some entity accountable. So thank you again, Guy. And for our listeners, please continue to do great self-care. Look to the Take Back the Night website for more resources. Call the hotline 567-SHATTER or fill out the form if you want more legal support. But otherwise, continue to join us each week for another episode of the Dear Katie podcast. to all of us. We will shatter the silence and end the violence together. Take care. Thank you again, everybody, for joining another episode of the Dear Katie podcast. I hope very much you found today's episode helpful, empowering, and a way to take another step in that long journey toward healing and supporting those we care about, learning about sexual violence prevention, and also survivor support. For those of you who don't know, again, the Take Back the Night website has tons of great resources, books, self-care options, cool merch. If you're feeling like you need a wearable, we have great t-shirts. Of course, we would love it if you follow along on our free newsletter with news and events going on around the country and even around the globe. And finally, don't forget to like us and follow us on Facebook and Instagram. You'll find our entire community popping up here and there, and recaps of our podcast episodes as well. So together we shatter the silence, and together we end the violence. Take care.